This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. 5 years, that's how long it's been since 27,000 gallons of fuel leaked from the military's Red Hill Underground Storage Tank Farm here on Oahu. Just yesterday, a Honolulu City Council committee advanced a resolution urging the state and the EPA to reject the Navy's plan to stay the course, maintaining the massive fuel tanks. Here's the Board of Water Supply's Chief Engineer Ernie Lau testifying before the council. He advocates either double lining the steel tanks or moving the facility away from our drinking water aquifer.
There were other sites in that study that was not over the drinking water aquifer on Navy property that we thought were viable sites. However, you know, they were not selected in the report. So I think there is a viable alternatives for relocation here. There is a lot of property within Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam, military property that they can build upon. It could be a putting tanks in different locations, so not all your eggs in one basket at one location. You can have fuel tankage storage in different location and above ground storage tanks that could be possibly constructed at a much cheaper cost than trying to double line the existing tanks. In fact, the Navy, the same Navy, has done similar actions of deciding not to upgrade underground field constructed tanks built around the World War II vintage, but decided to relocate them to new above ground storage tanks at a much cheaper cost. Manchester, Washington, Point Lomas, San Diego are some examples that we've been able to locate. So we believe there are alternatives here.
And the Navy's Red Hill Program Manager, Mark Manfredi, responded to that call for relocation.
We looked at about 12 different sites around Oahu. Off the top of my head, we looked at Campbell Industrial Park. We looked at Lu'ulu'u Way. I think that was about as far west as we went. We looked at Hickam Airfield. We looked at a few locations, both military and private, kind of in the immediate vicinity. And we looked at it from a number of different perspectives. We looked at it from an environmental perspective. We looked at it from a carbon footprint perspective, from the environmental side. We looked at it from a real estate perspective and permitting and all those kinds of things, available land and that type of thing. Again, I can't emphasize enough that it was a very preliminary study, but at the end of the day, what this report demonstrated was if you're going to rebuild, what surfaced to the top throughout this study was rebuild it on top of Red Hill.
And we had talked with Mark Manfredi and Navy Captain Mark DeLeo before this week's council meeting, and just as it released results from recent corrosion testing of the tanks by removing pieces of the steel lining, what it calls coupons. The military believes the data underscores it that its maintenance practices are sound, but the Board of Water Supply is concerned that in some places the tanks could be only a quarter inch thick.
You know, we use the word report, and I wanted to be very clear that in the context of the administrative order on consent, it's not the final report. What we're releasing is the data, right? So the information from, we've called it coupons, but they're really steel plates that we've cut out of a tank, and it's the data that corroborates and substantiates the testing and the inspection that we do on the tanks, and so what I want to say up front is the data absolutely substantiates what we expected to find in terms of the techniques we're using to inspect the tanks. You know, the regulators are going to see that as well. And then, as we've talked about before, you know, sort of this data also substantiates tanks are not leaking, that the water, the aquifer is safe, and that we continue, as the Navy, working with the regulators to do what we need to do to ensure that remains the case. And so I just wanted to state that up front. When we go into those tanks and do inspection, we use high-tech equipment to scan one side of the steel liner to understand what's going on the backside. And so this substantiates that by pulling out steel plates and actually looking at the backside and sort of comparing what we thought we were going to find with what we found.
Yeah, Catherine, this is Mark Manfredi. Prior to removing these coupons, we had to develop what we call a destructive testing plan. It was another interim product that we owed the regulators that kind of described exactly what we were doing and why we were doing it. And the plan, which was released, again, in the publicly releasable document that the Board of Water Supply had and has, it clearly articulates that the whole purpose of this exercise was not to evaluate the condition of the tank, but to evaluate our scanning processes, our ability to go into a tank and identify areas that need to be repaired and areas that don't. So in the course of doing that, we didn't want to turn the tank into Swiss cheese. We wanted to cut out, you know, hundreds or thousands of these samples and then have to go back and repair them all, which, you know, in a perfectly good tank. So we sat down with the regulators and we said, okay, we'll pull 10 coupons or 10 samples. Each one's about 12 inches by 12 inches. You know, we'll deliberately select coupons or samples from areas of the tank based on our scanning data where we believe there's backside corrosion. And that as a control, we'll deliberately select some from areas of the tank that we believe there's no backside corrosion and not in need of repair. And so we had selected these coupons knowing that the backsides of some of these things were going to have, evidence of some degree of corrosion going on. So that, there was no surprise there whatsoever before we went into it. And I think our laboratory results largely substantiate our predictions on that. It was not, let's quickly discuss what it is and what it isn't. So the lab report and the whole exercise of pulling these coupons was not about evaluating the condition of the tank. You can't do that with 10 coupons. You would need, you know, hundreds if not thousands of samples to get a statistically representative sample of the what's going on in the tank. That was not the purpose. The purpose, again, was to verify whether we accurately able to predict what we believe is going on behind the steel. That was the purpose of this drill. And again, I think the results largely substantiate that. Now, I'll caveat that with, you know, that being the case, you know, there's been a lot of things said out there about the corrosion's a lot worse than what the Navy thinks it is, that it's very thin. At least from the samples that we did pull, the laboratory results substantiate, again, that the corrosion or the degree of thinning on those plates was not significant, especially for steel that's been in these tanks for 75 years or so. In fact, the minimum of all the 10 plates, the minimum thickness that was measured was about 122 mils or 122 one-thousandths of an inch, which is more than twice the minimum API standard for the tanks. So in that regard, at least from these coupons, we're pretty comfortable with that.
Okay, so based on the findings, you don't believe there's a need to double line the tanks?
Well, that's a whole other topic.
So, Catherine, totally different topic. And what I'll say is, based on the steel plate testing and all the other measures we have in place, the water sampling, the tank tightness testing, all of the other math and science and measures that we have in place, what I can say is that the tanks are not leaking. And what I can say is that the water is absolutely pure and pristine, and it's the water that we purvey to the base, and then obviously Board of Water Supply has access to that water for purveyance to the population here at Oahu. So I can say that.
Well, what's the next step?
The next step, well, with the steel plates is we've released that, and so the regulators are reviewing it, and then in a couple of weeks we're going to have some face-to-face discussions, Navy with the EPA and the Department of Health. Board of Water Supply will be present to talk about the results, plus a lot of other information, and in terms of the AOC. But this is sort of a continuum of again working under the auspices of that administrative order on consent, and really understanding and sort of doing the right things for the right reasons with the tanks, but then also with the aquifer.
Yeah, and so just to give you a little bit more detail. So as far as this exercise goes, so this lab report that we, you know, submitted last week, this is essentially raw data. And so we will sit down with the regulators, well, we, you know, ourselves, but also with the regulators, and take that information and compare it to, you know, our maintenance practices and procedures, and evaluate whether they are good enough, if there's room for improvement, and then we go from there. So this is all about evaluating how effective our maintenance practices are, which is one element or one factor of consideration, you know, going back to your double wall question, that feeds into that. This in and of itself is not going to answer that question.
Is there a way to beef up the Sentinel system? I know you folks have put in the additional wells.
To answer your question, we are in the process now, as we speak, of installing four additional wells, monitoring wells, and one test hole. So a total of five. And that, you know, unfortunately took us about a year to get through all the permitting processes and all that kind of stuff to get the construction on these wells underway. As we put these wells in place and we gather the data from these wells, that data will feed into our modeling work. The modeling results will drive where, you know, if we need additional monitoring wells or sentinel wells, where exactly, how many, and where should they be located. And so that's a report that's probably a year or so down the pike. So a lot of work yet to be done in the groundwater modeling effort to get to that point.
Well, here it is, 2019.
Yep.
And we still don't really know where that original spill went.
Well, there's a lot of debate and a lot of discussion on that, and our folks would tell you that the lion's share of that fuel that came out of tank number five is trapped somewhere between the concrete that surrounds the tank and the surrounding earth, you know, that surrounds the concrete tank itself. And if you were to take a look at that space or area between the bottom of the tank and the surface of the aquifer, it's about 100 feet. We believe, based on our testing and evaluation, that it's in about the upper one-third of that area. We have never detected in all of our monitoring effort, and it just so happens that we have a well, monitoring well number two, just happens to be, it was installed before the release, but it just happens to be adjacent to tank number five. We've never detected any free product or whole fuel floating on the surface of the aquifer in that well, for that matter, any of the surrounding wells. Now, we do admittedly have levels of fuel constituents in the groundwater directly below the tanks that we continue to monitor and evaluate. We don't see signs of that contamination rising or spreading. We have pretty strong evidence that would indicate there's a significant degree of natural biodegradation going on. And, you know, so that's just kind of based on the data that we've been able to evaluate thus far. It's, like I mentioned earlier, that's still very much a work in progress. And it's a huge collaborative effort. It's not just the Navy, mind you. We work very closely with the EPA, Department of Health, Board of Water Supply, USGS, DLNR, Commission of Water Resource Management, University of Hawaii, all part of this groundwater modeling working group where, you know, we present, you know, our beliefs and our findings and they provide us with feedback and, you know, we take all of this input and figure out what's the best, you know, what is this all telling us, what's the best way forward. So I think it's a pretty significant effort. And that's frankly all a product of the AOC. I don't think we would have that degree of collaboration.
But we still don't know what's the best solution if we can even remove the escaped fuel, correct?
That will be part of the end result or products of the deliverables. What is the remediation? What is the appropriate remediation for that fuel? And the reality is that it is trapped in the basalt. You think of the, I like to use the term a sponge, but it's obviously not soft like a sponge, but it effectively absorbs or traps the fuel in these little pores. And so you just can't, it's not like a puddle of fuel somewhere where you could stick a straw in and suck it out. It's more kind of like, you know, if you spilled a gallon of paint or oil or something on your driveway, you can mop it up a little bit, but eventually you're still going to have a stain there, and that's kind of what we're dealing with.
Based on this latest data that you've reviewed, that the situation is stable?
Yes, I think so. I think it is stable.
I would say, Catherine, you know, just sort of facts and figures that as we go into the tanks and execute our clean, inspect, repair, and we're very judicious about that, that as Mark said, tanks have been there for 75 years, and there is some corrosion and thinning, but as we go into these tanks, we're repairing between 1-2% of the tank, and that's a really, really small percentage of that large area. And I think that's important to understand that, you know, we're doing the maintenance, we're doing the sustainment, and we're not finding large areas for repair. We're finding small pockets throughout a very large tank, and it all in aggregate represents about 1 to 2% of the total tank surface area. And I think that's important to note.
It's possible that they could come back and say, "Hey, we want you to cut out some more coupons or something mm-hmm. like that," and we'll just have to go from there. If you ask us to do that, you have to recognize that it's not going to happen overnight.
Okay. All right. So you expect once this gets released, all the parties will have a chance to weigh in, and then you think there'd be a public meeting?
And we've talked about this before. The tank upgrade alternative report is a homework assignment, if you will, that we're still working on with the regulators. And a lot of these items and the analysis that we're doing will feed into that product, and it's still in draft, and we're looking at later sometime this year sort of turning in our homework to EPA and DOH, and that represents sort of a large body of work with these studies and this analysis feeding in to that in some degree. And as Mark said, that document will sort of lay out the long-term plan for the tanks and sort of go into details on what we're going to do in perpetuity up there at Red Hill.
Again, the military plans to release that official final report later this year. The EPA characterized what was turned over to the Health Department last week as a raw data dump requested by the state. Both the State Health Department and Board of Water Supply told HPR it will need time to analyze the technical data, so it's unclear if the state or county may ask for additional studies. At this week's council meeting, the Navy invited any council members who have not yet toured the facility out for a field trip. We should note that HPR has a request to visit the site. I personally asked immediately following the spill in 2014 while working in TV news and renewed that request annually, even as I was making the transition to radio news more than a year ago. And while the military did invite media bosses on a tour last fall, journalists who will be writing about it have not yet been allowed access. We do not believe our request is unreasonable. The last time media was allowed access may have been as far back as the 1990s. Continuing the conversation that was started by a forum on over-tourism held in Kaka'ako last week. It was put on by Zocalo Public Square and the Daniel K. Inouye Institute. And following that event, several people wanted to hear from decision makers. So we invited Senator Glenn Wakai, who heads the Senate Tourism Committee and who was one of several lawmakers who happened to be in the audience that night.
The community is rightfully asking the right questions finally. Because before, chasing tourism growth numbers, we measure success purely by body count. And to the credit of HTA in the past, that number has steadily increased over time. But I think as we've matured the market, we're asking much more focused questions on how much, where, and those are important questions which we really don't have the answers for at the moment. But certainly, we need to better manage the entire tourism product.
What about the marketing money? Because that was an issue that came up at the Town Square event.
Yeah, I have heard people's commentary loud and clear. And in fact, last year we had a proposal to dramatically cut HTA's marketing funds. At that time it was $83 million. And we were at one point in the legislative discussion going to cut that down by $22 million, most of that going into DLNR and making sure that our resources are preserved. But it's funny because people always like to complain about why things don't happen. And when lawmakers or others put a proposal there, there's silence. And there's no one who will actively advocate for reallocation of the resources. All people want to do is gripe about it after the fact that why didn't this happen? Well, it could have happened if people were paying attention, but absent their attention, the hotel industry and the tourism folks who make their living off of bringing in more bodies were advocating to keep the marketing funds as they were. So We had that discussion, but the public should really get engaged in policymaking to effectuate the outcome rather than complaining about it because they were not paying attention.
We're also hearing this week about how the numbers for the early part of this year have softened, and there's a push by some to increase the marketing money.
Well, I think that's we've made it clear from the legislature to Chris Tatum at HTA, the new CEO, that he needs to take his foot off the gas and really look at cultural enrichment, natural resource preservation, and workforce development. So if the evolution of tourism is such where we're naturally going to get less tourists, then I think that might be a blessing in disguise. But, I don't hear of Chris, and we're not giving him more money to go and market even more fully than previous years. He's actually got a $3 million cut in his budget. So he just doesn't have as many resources as previous CEOs at HTA to go and market Hawaii to their planet.
And were you struck by anything in particular during our conversation about over-tourism?
I was struck by the necessity for people to, or the commentary for people who believe that we should have more resources into devoted to managing the product better. And, you know, another facet that was evident there that's really a trouble spot for us as a community is the role of short-term vacation rentals and how they are part of the community, but not to the point where they're a burden on our community. And it goes back to what I mentioned earlier about just how do we allocate the budget for HTA. The public really needs to get involved because absent their involvement, the legislature has failed for 3 years already on trying to put some kind of guardrails around short-term vacation rentals. So people can't just be griping at public forums after the fact. They need to really get engaged and help us move the needle in the direction that they see fit and help us finally get our hands wrapped around short-term vacation rentals and their dramatic impact on our communities.
During our show recently, we've had lots of calls concerning the enforcement, and I know that's something that each county seems to be grappling with. I think it's Maui County was actually suing someone. So every county is doing it a little bit differently.
You can't just say, well, we've been derelict for 30 years, so we're just going to make everybody legal tomorrow. I think we have to set up the rules of engagement first and then see how people fit into those rules. On the legislative front, we've really struggled with that because on the Senate side, we really want to put the screws to the platforms, require the Airbnbs and the HomeAways to give us information, to collect the taxes, and to take down bad actors. On the House side, they rather just kind of go after tax collections, and the rest of it is not something that they're interested in trying to really wrap their hands around. They just kind of punt it over to the counties to figure out what the local rules are. But this really has to be a collaborative effort between the counties as well as the state to make sure that we are better managing our communities, because right now we are all being, if you use the term, kind of victimized by whatever the platforms want to do in our areas. And we really need to turn the ship around and let the platforms know that this is our community and we're the ones driving this rather than the other way around.
And this is all connected to our housing crisis.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is a bigger social. The social impact is far more egregious than just the monetary losses of taxes, is the fact that we're supposed to build 26,000 housing units to meet our current demand in the future. And the fact that somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 or 22,000 units are in short-term vacation rentals makes absolutely no sense. We really need to kind of plug in the holes, put some of these 22,000 units back on the market for short-term vacation rental, and then figure out what is it that the state needs to kind of incentivize to create more rental housing for our community. But to continue to not look at the Airbnbs and the short-term vacation rentals as the biggest problem with our lack of housing is ridiculous for us to just continue to ignore. So we, on the Senate side, have two bills that are going to try and put some lassos around the short-term vacation rentals. I believe the House has one bill that, again, only focuses on taxing these folks. But, you know, to be honest, if we just purely look at these platforms as a means to for taxation and not worry about whether they're legal, whether they're permitted, it's kind of a crazy situation. It's kind of as if the state were to tax cocaine dealers. Somehow we can't take taxes from activities that are illegal. And why we can't figure that out on the local level as well as the state level is just baffling to me. We got to be in concert with each other.
Have you had any recent experience of this overtourism, either here locally or abroad?
To be honest, I travel a lot abroad, and I've seen it many Airbnbs, and in most cases, the owner is absent. And that's another issue, right? Is this really home sharing, or is this simply a greedy mechanism for homeowners to pay off their mortgages? I mean, I see that Airbnbs and short-term vacation rentals are an important part of our tourism offering. I just wish that we could figure out what is an appropriate number and what regulations, whether it's insurance, whether it's safety. We have to have some guidelines for these individuals who are sharing their homes, absent or otherwise living there with potential visitors to our islands.
And what about the extra funding maybe for the counties because of the stress and the burden on the first responders when they go after tourists who fell off a hiking trail or need to be rescued somewhere?
Well, you know, I think there's two parts to that issue. I think if you're someplace you're not supposed to be, we should be looking at making you pay for the rescue operation rather than all of us who are law-abiding citizens having to pay for the renegades out there. But on the other front, about incentivizing the counties with some portion of the GET, I'm all for that. But while the counties don't see this as a huge revenue opportunity, whether it's through licensing fees or increase in property taxes, they should more than make up for any kind of expenditure for enforcement. And why they continue to ignore that, and I shouldn't say they, it's pretty much Oahu. The other three neighbor island counties are pretty diligent at putting some lassos around short-term vacation rentals. But for whatever reason, Honolulu is just paralyzed and always uses, well, we don't have the money, we don't have the bodies to enforce this, as a reason for them to continue to do absolutely nothing. Is just I just don't understand that position by the Honolulu County. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to share my thoughts.
That was Senator Glenn Mackay talking about overtourism and what lawmakers are weighing this session as possible solutions to overtourism and the relationship to illegal vacation rentals and our housing crisis.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii. Walk on the Wild Side features live music, keiki activities, and more March 23rd at Fort Street Mall and Chinatown. KidneyHI.org/WOWS.
We've been hearing a lot about measles lately and how contagious it is. Well, that's the subject of our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Kauai columnist Aaron Parkini is on the line. Morning, Alan.
Hi, good morning.
So you initiated this, huh? You asked the Department of Education what the lay of the land is in our schools.
Well, we actually asked the Department of Health to tell us what the exemption rates were for each individual school in the state. That's how this started, only it turned out that they don't know. And that's actually more worrisome to me than disclosure of high rates of exemption, or unnecessarily high rates of exemption. If you're a parent in Hawaii and you don't wish to have your child vaccinated, you can either get a doctor's excuse or you can express a religious objection to vaccination. And the health department is supposed to keep track of how many of each of those there are at each school. So, and in many parts of the country, a good example would be King County, that's Seattle, Washington. The information on how many kids in each school are exempt from vaccination is posted on easily accessible websites in Hawaii. It turns out that the department doesn't even know whether or how many of 30 or even 40% of kids are exempt or not exempt, because the data are not being collected and analyzed.
So it's interesting.
So a parent would be, first of all, there is no website. There is no public way to find out whether the school your child may be going to has a very high anti-vaccination rate, or whether you as a parent have the ability to determine whether it's even safe to send your child to that school.
So you found that basically the schools report directly to the Department of Health, but not all the schools were complying.
That's correct. The schools are supposed to report their exemption rates to the Department of Health, but between 30 and 40% haven't done so. That's in part because the Department of Health has had, for the last 4 or 5 years, this is not a new problem. It's been this way for 4 or 5 years because the Department of Health says they've been having some personnel turnover problems, and that the person who fills the function of making sure these reports are all received and recorded, they've not been able to provide somebody consistently in that position. It's a big department. I'm not quite sure why there would be such a problem that affects the entire state's perception of vaccination rates so severely just because one person can't be retained and trained.
It seems to me, though, that DOE, as a statewide system, could get the districts to report to the deputy supes, and then all that data, you know, should be collated and then presented to the Department of Health. I don't know. Just a thought.
You would think. As it is, if you're a parent and you show up and you have a child you want to enroll in a school, the school is, in fact, required to find out if your child is vaccinated. So it's probably true that there aren't any kids in school who don't either have the vaccinations or a legal exemption. But what isn't known is what those numbers are statewide and by school, so that intelligent decisions can be made by parents, and so that you can see patterns of communities where vaccination is being rejected. And really, let's be clear about this. The old bromide about, well, vaccines are bad for you, vaccines cause autism, those are fallacious, almost conspiracy theory beliefs that have been debunked completely. So there is a right to know involved for parents in terms of what the situation at any particular school is. Are 10%, 5%, 2%, 30% of the kids at that school unvaccinated? Families have a right to know that.
That's right. Well, you know, I happened to be in Seattle when they had that outbreak there and declared an emergency, so I appreciate that you followed up here.
Sure enough.
Thanks so much. That was Kauai columnist Aaron Perichini with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit sillabeat.org.
Hi, my name is Nico Chaise, chef owner of Nico's restaurant, the Pierre Fellier. We decided to be underwriter of Hawaii Public Radio. The main reason is I am a listener and I needed to be more connected at the personal level and also business level. I think every restaurant should be an underwriter of HPR, and I always tell people you're only going to benefit from it.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting, your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hawaii has its fair share of baby boomers, but are we ready as a community for what's in store as many of us approach retirement? ARP's Sarah Gill joins us this morning to talk about this very important issue about saving for retirement. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're here from D.C., and so you've kind of gone across the country to see what's in place in other states. So tell us about that.
Absolutely. So what we know is that roughly one out of every two households is at risk for a financially insecure retirement. And that doesn't mean you're not going to be able to visit your grandkids or buy a birthday gift. It means you're not going to be able to afford your utility bill to pay for your prescription drugs. So states are taking action and making sure that workers throughout their states have a way to save through payroll deduction at work.
And the problem is that we just don't have enough of those systems in place, right?
Exactly. So 216,000 workers across the state of Hawaii, so about 50% of the private sector workforce, can't save out of their regular paycheck for retirement. And this is particularly important because what we know is that people are 15 times more likely to save for retirement if they can do so out of their paycheck.
So when we talked about this issue last year, I think Senator Laura Thielen had introduced a bill because she read something about a program that Oregon has.
Absolutely. Oregon is taking the lead on this issue, and they've set up a turnkey retirement program for small business owners to use, but they don't have to pay for it and they don't have to operate it. So we've got roughly 66,000 workers in Oregon that are now saving for retirement over the last year and a half since the program's been up and running, and they've got $14 million saved for retirement this far.
So what happened with Hawaii? This bill didn't go very far last year.
Yeah, last year we talked about doing a study and moving on this issue, and there was a lot of buzz about it at the legislature, but unfortunately it didn't make it over the finish line, so we're coming back this year.
And so where are we at? What has survived so far?
So there were two bills originally, and we are moving forward with the Senate bill, which is going to be the vehicle for this measure. It passed out of Ways and Means on Monday, and we expect a floor vote soon.
So why is this so critical? Why do people need to pay attention to this kind of stuff?
Well, I think there's two reasons. First, obviously, it's really important to make sure people can live independently as they age so they can kind of define their retirement years in the way they want to. Secondarily, it's important for taxpayers. So what we know is that if people don't save enough for retirement, taxpayers are going to be on the hook down the line on social safety net programs. And AARP's research has shown that if we can help people save an extra $1,000 a year for retirement, we will save $32 million over 15 years in Hawaii.
I was looking at something that said that basically you should take your salary times 10. That's what you need to have socked away somewhere in a 401k or something.
Yeah, isn't that scary? I think those numbers really make people palpably nervous. And so what we always say, too, is consider the impact of Social Security. So if you can wait to take Social Security either to your full retirement age or beyond that, you get an extra 8% per year in your Social Security benefit. And that's money you can't outlive and you'll get every month.
I know some people worry about how much longer Social Security is going to be around, though.
People do worry about it, but, it's fully funded for, over the next decade. And after that, actually, there is funding. It just becomes pay as you go.
So what about this legislation that's pending and whether it covers, let's say, nonprofits?
Nonprofits absolutely could use Hawaii Saves. And in fact, there are other states, including Massachusetts, that are looking at programs specifically for nonprofits because we know that just like small businesses, nonprofits run on very tight margins and they're busy keeping their doors open. So we're very engaged in making sure that they can offer retirement benefits to their workers.
So as you've gone from state to state, what's the snapshot for Hawaii? Are you more worried for us?
I have to say, I've been here almost a week now, so I've heard a lot about cost of living and housing in Hawaii. And those are two big indicators for financial insecurity in retirement. So I am very concerned about Hawaii. I think, if Hawaii falls about in the middle of the pack in terms of access to retirement, one out of every two workers, right, doesn't have a way to save. But the cost of living is a serious concern.
So whether it's a bill that will kick off a study, we've got to do something as soon as we can.
Yeah, waiting is just not an option.
And the costs are going to be even bigger if we wait.
Exactly. Every year we wait, we know taxpayers are going to pay more and more.
And here in Hawaii, I know lots of folks actually work 2 and 3 jobs really just to make ends meet. And as you get to a point where you don't have the energy to work 2 or 3 jobs, what then?
Exactly. I tell a joke that's unfortunate but true. The new word for retirement is work. People are working longer. They're phasing in their retirement. They're not just working one day and retired the next. And so we need a retirement program in this country that allows gig workers and people who are working more than one jobs to be able to easily and automatically plug into a retirement plan.
Do you see a big obstacle with the Hawaii passing something this session?
I don't. I think what I see is that there's a lot of options out there, and the state of Hawaii is really discussing what's most appropriate for Hawaii. And I think actually that's what's so exciting about this this method is that every state is a little bit different, and so Hawaii can come up with a solution that works for it rather than, you know, what works for Hawaii isn't going to work for South Carolina and vice versa.
Okay. Well, Sarah Gill, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with ARP Sarah Gill, who will continue this conversation tonight on PBS Hawaii's Insight Show later this evening.
Hi, aloha, I'm Kelly Markgraf from Hawaii Opera Theater. If you liked today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org.
After the financial crisis, Wall Street banks paid billions of dollars in fines and settlements. Was that, though, justice?
People who have wealth, who have money, who take advantage of the criminal laws and violate those criminal laws need to be prosecuted.
I'm Kai Rizdal. How settlements replaced jail sentences, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, former Governor Bill Weld. He's embarking on what seems like a political suicide mission, challenging Donald Trump in the Republican primary for the 2020 election.
I just can't sit quietly by anymore and witness what he's doing both internationally and domestically. I think it's a train wreck.
I'll talk with Bill Weld next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Sunday morning at 9.
The debate over funding public education has a new twist this legislative session. Last year, a coalition of teachers, parents, and public education advocates wanted to amend the state constitution to allow a special property tax to fund public education. The movement failed when the Supreme Court invalidated the ballot question. This year, there's an effort to increase funding for public schools by a different means. HPR's Ryan Finnerty tells us more.
Does any of this sound familiar?
This is an additional tax that is being created that'll affect the entire state of Hawaii.
The question is this to me. Should you put a constitutional amendment to take away the authority of property tax that county governments have? I don't care who you are, you will be affected one way or the other.
These wealthy investors cannot win this ballot question on their own. So the only way they're going to win is by convincing people to vote against their self-interest and to vote against their own children.
Last summer, a heated statewide debate erupted around funding for public education. In the spring, the state legislature approved a ballot referendum asking Hawaii voters whether or not they wanted to increase property taxes to fund public schools. The state Supreme Court invalidated the referendum question for being too vague. The idea was opposed by all four county mayors and business advocacy groups. On the other side of the debate was the Hawaii State Teachers Union and many parents. Increasing funding for public schools is once again on the agenda of Hawaii lawmakers. State Senator Brian Taniguchi introduced a bill to do just that.
To me, we've historically underfunded the schools and our public education. We underpay our teachers. You know, a lot of times the facilities aren't up to par. We don't have adequate equipment, computers, laptops, iPads, electronic equipment that we really need to have our students compete in the global economy. And so I think that we really need to have more additional resources.
Taniguchi wants to increase the state's general excise tax by 0.5%, with a portion of that new revenue going to education funding.
Initially, we thought about just kind of a guideline, and we thought maybe something like $200 million in additional monies to the Department of Education would be something that would be what we were looking for, and $50 million for higher education, which would be University of Hawaii Manoa, the two four-year colleges, and our community college system.
Taniguchi estimates his proposal would raise between $300 and $350 million in revenue. That's more than the $50 million that was projected to come from the property tax amendment. Public education advocates welcome the idea.
We have to find funding for our schools, and right now Hawaii is in a crisis. We have over 1,000 classrooms without a qualified teacher. More and more of our teachers are moving to the mainland because we're just not paying our teachers enough here in Hawaii.
That's Corey Rosenlee, president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association. He was one of the most forceful advocates for the property tax amendment and says this proposal is a start.
We spend about $6,000 less per pupil than our comparative school districts. That actually would be about $1 billion. This is not bringing $1 billion. This brings in over $300 million. But this is a step in the right direction to make sure that, you know, we fund our schools properly.
Rosenlee often says increasing teacher pay is the most pressing need. Hawaii teachers are consistently ranked at or near the bottom nationally for cost of living adjusted compensation. But Rosenlee says there are other issues that also need funding.
Right now, we have a huge gap in our facilities. Our schools are aging and getting older and falling apart. They need a huge influx, and we're already behind on that one. One of the things that we're hoping is that if we can increase funding, right now we have a shortage of about 500 special education teachers in Hawaii. And believe it or not, that's actually lower than what it should be. In 2009, the ratio was higher. We probably need about 700 or 800 special education teachers in Hawaii alone.
Public school students from kindergarten through 12th grade won't be the only ones to benefit.
We were an extremely low tuition state through the mid-1990s, and that's when a shift very consciously was made.
That's David Lassner, president of the University of Hawaii system. In an interview last year, Lassner told HPR that much of the increase in public university tuition around the country can be attributed to funding cuts from state legislatures over the past 30 years.
Since that period, in other recessions, we have had our funding cut. And those tend to be the periods when tuition rose the most. At one period, when I looked at the five-year data around 2013, Hawaii was the state that had one of the highest per capita decreases in state funding per student. At the same time, our tuition went up among the highest in the country. So those two things are correlated, and that turns out to be true across the country.
If UH gets the additional $50 million envisioned by Senator Taniguchi, it would almost double the university's requested funding increase for 2019. But tax hawks want to remind everyone where all that money is coming from.
It's a tax increase because the base rate of the GE goes from 4 to 4.5%.
Tom Yamachika is the president of the Tax Foundation of Hawaii. He points out that the GET is a regressive tax, meaning it hits low earners the hardest. That's very different from the property tax proposal, which would have targeted high-value properties.
When people measure our tax system for how progressive or how regressive it is, what they normally find is that our tax system is regressive primarily because we depend on the GET so much. People on the lower end of the spectrum pay more of their income in state tax because they're buying necessities and taxes imposed on those. Increasing the GET makes that more pronounced.
Senator Taniguchi says he is concerned about increasing a regressive tax, but adds there are ways to offset that increase.
I do have concerns about the regressivity of the excise tax. However, I did also introduce a food tax credit bill. We have tools within our taxation system, like the earned income tax credit, that can help people with less income and to avoid the regressivity of the excise tax.
Teachers Union President Corey Rosenlee also isn't swayed by such arguments against the tax increase.
There are some people that, regardless of how we do it, are just never going to want to spend money to fund our schools. It's short-sighted to not understand that when we fund our keiki, the benefits to society are great. And no matter how you ever do it, you could do all of their answers and they just find another excuse. I think that as a society, we've got to be willing to say, yes, we are willing to sacrifice a little so that our keiki get a lot.
The proposed increase still has a long road before it could become law. The powerful Senate Ways and Means Committee will decide today whether to kill the bill or send it to the full Senate for a vote. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
As we mentioned, the Senate Ways and Means Committee heard that GE tax bill. We've just heard back from Ryan. They deferred a vote until tomorrow, and we'll have an update for you on HPR News.
Hi, I'm Brian Dote from Mid-Pacific. You're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Find our stories on Twitter or tweet us at HIConversation.
Okay, do you think we can really hear ourselves?
Maybe.
Scientists sailed for weeks to reach Thwaites Glacier, part of the Antarctic ice sheet that's melting. There's a lot of research ahead, but first...
Woo! Oh, that was amazing. You can bounce your voice off the glacier.
Yep. Bouncing your voice off a glacier and getting serious about global warming in Antarctica.
Oh.
It's the world.
This afternoon at 1.
Well, that is it for today. Up tomorrow, we talk about the recent damage to our highways and roads here on Oahu, Maui, and the Big Island due to landslides. What's up with that? Tell us what's on your mind. Are you affected by the Pali? What's the situation on the Valley Isle? And how are things there in Hawaii County? Call our talkback line. Leave us your comment. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of the show or want to find a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.